Roel and I had planned this series we called Miss America as sort of a pun, and also, I don't want to talk about it, but Miss USA, the real thing, is a student of mine, a major in American Studies at St. Olaf, and so I suppose I'm close to Miss America or Miss USA in that sense, and so on. If anybody wants to ask, she's not in the standard mold at all. She's a very good student and very hardworking and very career conscious, and just a joy to have around. But anyway, we'd rather talk about Miss America, and I'll pick up in a chronological sense where Roel stopped last time, and try to add some ideas of my own and evaluations of my own on the general theme that we've been talking about, and zero in especially on the changing patterns of what we would call heroes as they express certain myths about American culture. And the subtitle for today is From Jack Armstrong to Doonesbury. And I've found out, been asking some people already, especially anybody under, 30, I suppose, or maybe 35 even, who Jack Armstrong was, and very few and very few knew. But those of us who are over, we know. Should we sing it? Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. Won't you try Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land? So won't you, all right. They're, what is it? They're crunchy, they're crispy the whole night through, or what is it?
That's right.
Jack Armstrong never tires of them, and neither will you. Right, so won't you try Wheaties? There's Nancy. Is anybody scheduled for noon in here? Well, I'll stay then, fine, if anybody wants to. There wasn't anybody on the board in the Friday. The little blue sheet or blue circle, wasn't anybody there, so I just volunteered. Okay, so
maybe so beyond the song, you perhaps should explain who Jack Armstrong was.
Yeah, I'm going to. Right, yeah, I'm going to explain who Jack Armstrong was.
I don't think that was clear from our singer.
Really? Or we could do Tom Mix, you know, and the writers of the Purple Sage, Captain Midnight, right, and Little Orphan Annie, and all of them. Really. Before the days, and there were days before television, there really were. There was life before television on this planet. And although that goes the other way, too, there's a wonderful book out called Is There Life After 30? I always like that one as a title. But beforehand, there were very important and revealing stories for young people, which were serials, that is, continuous stories on the radio, which were every day, Monday through Friday, usually right after school. And I can remember vividly running home as fast as possible to make it right on good old WCCO, where you could hear Jack Armstrong for 15 minutes and Captain Midnight, Tom Mix, Little Orphan Annie, and some others that didn't make it. These were the ones who really sort of survived more than anything.
Don't forget the Lone Ranger.
Lone Ranger survived.
I think I ate more supper by the radio than I ever did at the table.
Yeah, right. They had radio dinners. They didn't have Swanson's TV dinners in those days. They had radio dinners. Our parents were glad that it kept us quiet after school. But I think these stories. Then I want to talk. What I want to talk about is briefly outline, especially Jack Armstrong and the sort of the underlying code of morality, the kind of myths that are reflected and really inculcated in Jack Armstrong and what he stood for, and Captain Jack and Betty and Billy and all of them. And then why the change, why the transition, especially today when you don't find these anymore. You simply can't find radio serials adventure stories anymore. But the most popular, and I think the most important comic strip, and I want to talk, the comic strip we have available now is Doonesbury. And I want to talk about this because, not only because how we make the transition from radio to the audio to the visual, but the ideals, the code of morality, which is reflected in Gary Trudeau's famous comic strip, which got started as a piece for the Yale Daily, and now really is in almost all of the big newspapers in the country. It's in the Seattle Times, and if any of you haven't started with it, and if you get the Seattle Times, I would strongly recommend you do it, because I think it is very revealing of the kind of changes, the kind of cultural change transformation that have taken place. Now, why look at the young people's stories? What do they tell us about our culture? They tell us, I think, primarily what the adult world expects young people to become, what adults expect young people to be. This is especially true in the 40s and 50s with stories like Jack Armstrong. Jack Armstrong simply wasn't a character, or the story wasn't simply, an interesting adventure story which you listened to and which you forgot. But there were attempts, very careful attempts, I think, on the part of the adult world to inculcate certain very precisely defined moral expectations from the young people. And the fact that Jack Armstrong, along with the others, had such a wide representation, was accepted by such a wide audience, I think, suggests that it did sort of represent what we would call a national consensus. That is, no matter what part of the country you were in, if it could be far west or New England, deep south, Midwest, wherever, everybody was united in a very real sense by Jack Armstrong and by this kind of code of morality. Therefore, if you were looking at, you know, what a country believes in, what are its values, its ideals, and all the rest, one very good way of doing this is looking at the children's stories, and not just the adventure stories, but the kinds of stories that had sort of moral endings to them. I'm drawing here especially in a book I would recommend very highly from a work by a professor of psychology at Harvard, David McClelland, and he calls it The Achieving Society. And what he has done is take different children's stories from all over the world, David McClelland, The Achieving Society, and he has compared them one to another and has found certain national characteristics that are indigenous to each of these sort of groups of children's stories. And he finds children's stories in India, for instance, are much different than those from South America, or those from the United States are much different from those in other parts of the world. And hence, Jack Armstrong becomes not simply, you know, a lot of fun and a lot of nostalgia, which it is, and I think if you take it in that respect, it's good fun, but it also becomes something which tells us a little bit more accurately than we knew before, I think, about the kind of world in the 40s and the 50s. And what I want to try to ask, the question I want to raise after going through Jack Armstrong and then why the switch to Doonesbury, is have we sort of gained or have we lost something in this transformation? Are we maybe a little bit too sophisticated, a little bit too cynical, a little bit, you know, too anti-straight and anti-square today? Because if you ever want to know the definition of what a straight or a square was, you would look at Jack Armstrong and the terms of what people under 30 mean by straights and squares. It's funny how that term has turned around, because in the 20s and the 30s, it was a good thing to be square. To be four square was really fine, and somebody was on the square, that is, you could depend on it. Now to be called a square, you know, is really a term of opprobrium, of criticism, and I think the transformation may tell us something about the world in which we live today. Okay. Jack Armstrong, I've just listed down about seven or eight characteristics of the story itself, which I think are important, worth mentioning, and these are not in any specific order of importance. I've just listed these. If I ever would do anything with this, I'll make it more, in terms of publication, I'll make it more logical and unfolding here, but these are just the way they come out, and if anybody wants to add, subtract, or disagree with any of these things, I'd be very happy to open it up. First of all, with Jack Armstrong in the 40s, especially in the 50s, the emphasis is on activism, on action. They're always up and doing things. There is very little time for what we would call intellectual reflection or study, or you don't find Jack Armstrong or Billy and Betty. They were twins, weren't they? Billy and Betty, as I remember, they were twins with Captain Jack as sort of the adult hovering over all the time. When they got in real trouble, always the adult would bail them out and so on. But you don't find them ever reading books, for instance. You don't find them even listening to the radio. They weren't listening to themselves. It's just like today on soap operas. You never see people on soap operas watching television. That's always struck me as kind of curious why this is the case. I got hooked on As the World Turns for 10 years. I might as well finish the stories when I'm off it. Now, I remember the famous trial when Ellen was suing David for custody of Dan, was it, when Dan was just growing up? And just as the trial was going to come to a conclusion and the judge was going to end, this actually happened when the judge was going to announce his verdict, our set broke. And we were so embarrassed we didn't dare tell our neighbor, ask our neighbor. We called my sister down in Forest City, Iowa, to find out how the trial came out. Because we knew Elsie wouldn't, you know, sort of laugh at us. But our neighbors might think, you know, we had gone spacey or something. My sister sort of looked at me the next time, you know, but we saw each other. But Jack Armstrong's life, by contrast to many of the archetypes and the mythological figures which you find today, are very much involved in up and doing all the time. Furthermore, they're always involved in helping others. There's always an element of the heroic in there. There's always an element of something daring, something challenging, and it's almost always physical in nature. And by, you know, the old Puritan work ethic here, by hard work, self-discipline, you know, delay of instant gratification for, you know, a reward farther down the line, good and right and justice always triumph, much as you were saying with the Virginian yesterday, that these solid virtues always triumph. That if something goes wrong, you see, you always have to account for failure or setbacks in the system when you're talking this way. When something goes wrong, it's because the individual himself was wrong, or that he misjudged, or he didn't have enough information, or that he wasn't persistent enough. And therefore, it's necessary to inculcate the virtues, you see, of hard work, self-discipline in young people to let them know that so long as they work hard, save all these, you know, in Minneapolis we have a bank that says tuck a buck a day away. And so long as you carry on the old Puritan virtues, you see, of thrift and these things, that justice will triumph in the end. Furthermore, along the same line in Jack Armstrong, there was always a happy ending. There would be adventures that would take you long enough. They could be mountain climbing or fishing or rafting or whatever, tenting. And there would always be some peril, that physical peril would come along, some bad guys or a storm or whatever with this. But always a happy ending. And there had to be resolved with a happy ending so that you knew that if you followed the established moral code, that happy endings were not just a pipe dream, but happy endings were something which would come to you. And most important here, I think, with Jack Armstrong, and this is the sort of the biggie of my points here that I want to comment to when we get to Doonesbury, Jack Armstrong and the others assumed what you could call a fixed moral code. They assumed a consensus of what was considered to be moral and just in the society. There was no real disagreement or disharmony in the radio serials for young people about what constituted right and wrong. Right and wrong were always very clearly defined, just like in most Westerns. The advantage of the Western before it got into, you know, the kind of the realistic Western or the naturalistic Western was that it was always right and wrong, and like the, you know, the white hat and the good guys and so on. And you could tell this, and you knew that in the last analysis, good would triumph. But the point really is to remember, and I want to underline that, is that good and evil are always clearly defined. And that once you understand what this is, then you understand that the way you get along in life, you see, once you grow up, is to follow this code of behavior. That this is what's expected of you, that you don't have any real doubts in your mind as what society will allow and what society will, you know, disapprove of. All right. So there is this fixed, as I say, this fixed standard of morality. And the highest good really is to be straight. That is, by straight I mean to follow and obey this code of morality. And by doing so, society would approve you, Captain Jack would say some good things about you, the community might reward you, whatever might be the case, there was reinforcement for this kind of behavior. Now, this kind of behavior also was, how should I say this? This kind of behavior, I got stuck on this point, depended on respect for basic social institutions. There was very, we'll put it the other way, there was absolutely no even hint of criticism of basic social institutions in society in these young people's stories, such as Jack Armstrong and the rest at the time. You simply assumed that the family, in nuclear family, in and of itself was a good thing. The nuclear family was the basic unit of society in which children were reared and introduced into the real world, and that never is there any kind of doubt or questioning of the nuclear family. The same thing could be said for the school. The school, but the school was not really to inculcate and interest people in intellectual pursuits for its own sake, but the school was utilitarian. The school was for practical things. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and learning how to get along with people, social relations, and so on. And therefore, the school was beyond criticism, and the school was simply seen as a necessary, you know, and a useful thing in which to get involved. The same thing could be said for the whole world, I suppose you could say, of patriotism and loyalty to the country. It was assumed that everybody in Jack Armstrong and the other serials knew what patriotism was, and that patriotism was simply expected of people. There was never any real doubt about this. Of course, they, in World War II, they could have a great time with patriotism because it became so very easy to pitch good guys versus bad guys and right versus wrong in terms of the code of World War II. I can remember myself so very clearly when I was 12 years old. It was 1942, and we had, you know, just gotten into the war, and we drew pictures of what we thought Japanese people all looked like. And we drew these, and then we'd hold out the paper, and then we'd stab the paper, and then we'd laugh and laugh and laugh, and the teacher would sit there and, you know, didn't disapprove at all. But that was the way. Or sometimes some of these old Looney Tune comics come along, and there are some dreadful things about, you know, caricatures of Germans and Japanese that I can't believe happened, or some of the old World War II flicks, you know, Coming In on a Wing and a Prayer, and White Cliffs of Dover, and, you know, who was it? There's a Star Spangled Banner waving somewhere, remember? And there'll be Nathan Hale and Colin Kelly, too, and all the old appeals, you see, to loyalty to the country are expected from the young people, and heroes such as Jack Armstrong and Billy and Betty are good, loyal citizens, and so long as they respect family, so long as they go to school, so long as they obey their parents, so long as they're patriotic, they will always triumph in the end, and they will triumph in the end by following this established moral code with us. And equally important, along with respect for these institutions, is respect for capitalism. And it's no accident, obviously, that these programs were financed by very large institutions. Wheaties, of course, is General Mills out of Minneapolis, which is one of the great milling companies in the United States. And the most blatant one, this is a little off Jack Armstrong, but the most blatant one was Little Orphan Annie. I don't know if any of you can remember Little Orphan Annie, but Daddy Warbucks would make the John Birch Society look like left-wingers.
In most papers now, they're rerunning the old 1930s, late 1930s, and early 1940s Little Orphan Annie.
Are they?
Because they aren't redoing the strip, and when this runs out, they're going to stop it. But those are really militant.
Yeah, they extremely so, and it's quaint and almost frightening to think that that sort of thing passed for entertainment for young people. But the idea there was to instill the virtues of free enterprise, of capitalism, the market economy in young people, and never was there any kind of challenge of this. What I'm doing, obviously, is setting this up for the change that takes place later on when we get to Doonesbury. Now, within capitalism, the institution of capitalism, I think the most important moral virtue which the comic strips and the adventure serials like Jack Armstrong inculcated was what we call the American gospel of success. That is, by going to school, by obedience to law, by hard work, thrift, these things that we've talked about before, everybody had an equal chance in life, that America was still the land of opportunity, that America presented virtually unlimited chances for young people so long as they were hardworking, industrious, thrifty, imaginative, and that therefore in life everybody started at the same starting line and you got what you deserved in life, and that life was basically, the race of life, I suppose you could say, was basically fair, because those, you know, the race is to the strongest and to the swiftest, and those who succeeded in terms of dollars and prestige and status and all the rest deserved to, because they were making the maximum contribution to society, and those who didn't were those who were lazy or indolent or immoral or whatever the case might be. Let me give you an example I remember vividly, which illustrates this from my high school graduation in Kenyon, Minnesota. The commencement speaker said that life was like a farmer taking a load of apples to market. And you put lots of apples, this is, what is it, apple capital here, isn't it? And you put a lot of apples on a big wagon, and the farmer takes them to market, and there are plenty of ruts and bumps and curves and ditches and dangers and perils all along the way. And finally, when you get to market, the big juicy red ones are right up on the top where they belonged, and the little runty, wormy ones are right down the bottom where they belonged. And everybody cheered and thought that was very profound, because everybody had an equal chance in life. What they didn't mention, obviously, was, you know, the fact that some people, because of their sex or race or whatever it is, you know, didn't really start at the same starting line as all the rest of us did. But this becomes really, you know, the American gospel of success. And therefore, once you believe in the American gospel of success, such as they were trying to inculcate in young people in things like Jack Armstrong, you accounted for failure, or you accounted for poverty, you accounted for crime, you see, in terms of individual shortcomings, in the terms of the fact that the individual wasn't talented or bright or energetic or so on, and therefore there was no need, you see, it's very conservative, there was no need for any serious revamping or looking at the system itself in terms of changing the distribution of wealth or regulating corporate wealth or protecting the rights of minorities, anything along these lines, because it was only individual sin, if you want to put it that way, that we, you know, made the system go wrong. There was no really such thing as a social sin or social malfeasance. It was simply a matter of each individual having a full, a free opportunity, and many of these couldn't make it, but that was simply the life, that was simply life the way it was. Now, furthermore, with Jack Armstrong, I think that it inculcated one other, I suppose you could call it, social institution, and that was the subordination of women. always the heroes were boys. The heroes were men. There was Betty in there, but Betty was simply there to furnish some interest for the girl listeners, I'm sure, to the radio. But also, Betty knew her place, and the real heroics, the real rewards, always went to Jack and Billy and others who kind of came along with us. In Little Orphan Annie, Little Orphan Annie was really herself only a vehicle for Daddy Warbucks, who was the chief guru and leader in the movement. And Little Orphan Annie usually got herself into all sorts of difficulties. What was that famous expression? She was always, I forget, she was always saying. Anyway, it was always the man who would have to rescue her from, you know, the brink of disaster, just in the nick of time. And hence there was, again, no challenge, you see, to what we would call established institutions in any of these kinds of programs which had such great appeal. And finally, it should be said that in terms of sort of a McLuhan kind of analysis here about the way in which the medium determines the message, that these were done by radio and not either by television or in comic strips. Now, obviously, they didn't have television available at that time, so we can dismiss it. But the fact that they were on radio was very important, because in radio, you had to furnish your own imagination. You had to visualize yourself what was taking place. They could only do so much in terms of sound effects with thunder and doors closing and cars and so on and so forth. But the basic pattern as to what was happening had to come from your own mind. And hence, you had much, much more freedom in terms of what these people looked like or the kind of setting in which they were located than would be the case where you have, for instance, television, or even where you have newspapers, because in these places you have to locate the action in a specific, physical setting. And that gives it a certain kind of limitation. Even in Charlie Brown, even though there are never any adults in there, there's always a reference to some sort of physical setting that takes place. And therefore, one advantage, you see, of having radio is that you could locate it in Florida or Washington or Maine or California or whatever, wherever the case might be. And it has much, more broad appeal for that reason. And furthermore, since it requires that kind of input on the part of the listener, how should I say this? It lets them identify themselves much more clearly with the actors, because suddenly they can become Jack or they can become Billy, because all they have is their imagination. And they can envision Billy or Jack or the rest of these doing these things in their hometown, in Mountain Lake or in Frost, I'm just looking around here, or in Kenyon or wherever, this might happen. And it becomes, in that sense, much more real life to them. There wasn't anything sort of vague or science fiction about that, and that's important. There was strong science fiction in those days. Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, and we used to laugh about their talking about being on the moon, and having laser guns and so on that all have come true. And now we're on Mars and so on. But the point here is that since you didn't locate it in a specific geographical area, you could identify it with it that much, much more clearly. And you were led to believe, obviously, that these kinds of experiences really might, sort of happen to you. And that therefore, if you did what Jack did, and you were the kind of person that Jack Armstrong was, maybe you too could become a hero. Maybe you too could have this kind of adventure. Maybe your life back in a little small town during the Depression in Minnesota wouldn't just be quite as drab or dull as sometimes it seemed to be. And obviously other people, could share this with you. And we would, I remember after supper at night, we would go out and play Jack Armstrong. We would go out and find each other, our friends, Dick Tooney, I remember, and so I don't want to get on a nostalgia trip. But we would do these things in which we thought somehow mysteriously all this would happen to us. And hence what I'm trying to get at is I think in long-range terms, what the effect of Jack Armstrong and other comic strip and radio serial heroes, especially radio serial heroes like his, has been, is to create this sort of sense or this need or drive really for achievement, which we find in people ourselves over 35, over 40. Some of you heard, for instance, Al Pitcher talk about the fact that he feels oppressed in the sense that he is expected to achieve, he is expected to produce, he is expected to go far beyond simply doing a good day's work, but to make a major kind of contribution, and always feels this kind of pressure, what we call the achievement syndrome in America. And I think a lot of this can be attributed to the kinds of ideals and values and goals which were pumped into us when we were young people. This is the way to become a good American. This is the way to become a good Christian. Turn two talents into four and five into ten. If this meant, exploitation of the resources and so on, well, that was part of the game also. And I submit that one reason that there is some distance between younger people and people our age, for instance, and older today, is that we are still, many of us, caught up in the achievement syndrome. That it's very difficult for us to get out of this bag, because we've been taught from the beginning that this is the way to success and fame. I've heard Carol say, for instance, talk about people who have talked to him, that they would like to reduce their standard of living, they'd like to cut back, but they've got so many commitments, such a large mortgage, children's in college, and so many other things, that they can't, and they really don't enjoy their work as much as they would like to. They don't get a sense of fulfillment out of it anymore. It's simply there because if they don't, they're going to, find themselves in real trouble with the creditors and with other people who think they should pay their bills. Now, the real change in cultural heroes, I think, starts appearing in the late 1950s and certainly is in full bloom by the late 1960s. And there are several things, I think, that helped account for the breakdown of radio serials such as Jack Armstrong, Little Orphan Annie, and the others, which I'd like to mention. But I want to just briefly mention what I think are some of the reasons for the transition, and then go through very quickly what some of the new standards of morality are for, let's say, Doonesbury as the best example of this sort of thing, and then see where we go with discussion from that point on. I think World War II obviously was the great turning point in our lives, and it's just now, for instance, being reassessed in terms of its full contribution. There were just in the last New York Times Sunday Review or Sunday Book Review reviews of three new books, all of which look good, assessing what happened to America, what happened to the world really in World War II. And probably the most important thing, well, two or three of the leading things that happened, was a sense of ambiguity rather than clarity so far as the morality of America's presence in the world was concerned. I'm talking especially, of course, about the atomic bomb. And it seemed, even at the time that it happened, for many people so clear that if we hadn't done it, the war would have lasted that much longer and so on. But as the 40s became the 50s, and the Cold War set in, and the nuclear stalemate set in, we began to have some very serious doubts about the rightness of America and the wrongness of the Soviet Union so far as the use of nuclear weapons were concerned. A second factor, I think, that helped change us and lead us out of this sort of sense of shelter and innocence, really, that we had in the 30s, were the crematoriums. Because the crematoriums showed the extent or the depth, really, of evil that was possible in a nation which, called itself civilized. And the fact that it happened in Germany and not in the United States isn't as important as the fact that it happened in a nation which is within the Western community or family of nations itself, and therefore it stood as a signal that if we were making progress, as the old moral progress, as the old Puritan ethic said we were, it was certainly, a tremendous setback to that, because there is no way in which you can consider that to be a step ahead. Other factors that oftentimes are overlooked, I think, help break down this sense of isolation and provincialism which nourished Jack Armstrong and the old Puritan gospel of success. One would be the GI Bill for education after World War II, in which any veteran from World War II was guaranteed a college education. And for the first time, very large numbers of Americans now can get a college education, which you couldn't get before in World War II. A very small number of people could. Now almost anybody could, and with a college education, there was obviously much more social, educational mobility than had ever been the case before. And the United States was simply a different society altogether. The same thing can be said in terms just of geographical mobility. Millions of people left Keokuk and Chillicothe and so on and went to the West Coast or went to the East Coast and never returned again. They went to the Henry Kaiser shipyards in Alameda and so on, and there was no way you could get them back to Buffalo Center, Iowa after having been where some of my relatives are. after they had seen, you know, California. And hence, there was a much wider sense of how big America was, how much greater the opportunities were for moving around, for experiencing more to life than the small town routine, which had been the case, for instance, for me and many others in the 1930s. Another major impact, obviously, and one which we can only sort of guess as to the impact, would be television itself. And television was crucial in so many ways, but mostly because it brought a much greater sense of immediacy and geographical reality to the world than had been the case before. Now, and I think this shows up, for instance, in our heroes, in the myths we have America. Now it was impossible any longer to use your imagination, or it was no longer necessary to use your imagination in trying to visualize what somebody, let's say, like Jack Armstrong or Captain Midnight or Tom Mix or any of the rest of these really were involved with, because now everything could be focused on a very specific geographic location, and it took on a much greater sense of immediacy. And when this was the case, it was much more difficult to idealize or romanticize the setting. When you're setting in a certain, when you have a certain setting, you see it much more clearly, and you can't simply idealize it. Nor can you simply identify with it yourself. If you're from a small town, you can't idealize, or I should say, identify with a setting which is an urban setting or you know, a mountain setting, whatever the case might be. And took on a much greater sense of immediacy. And when this was the case, it was much more difficult to idealize or romanticize the setting. When you're setting in a certain, when you have a certain setting, you see it much more clearly, and you can't simply idealize it. Nor can you simply identify with it yourself. If you're from a small town, you can't idealize, or I should say, identify with a setting which is an urban setting or you know, a mountain setting, whatever the case might be. And hence, there is a much greater there is simply less idealization of a way of life which had some basis in reality in the 1930s and the early 1940s, but was no longer the case. And we find the change really taking place in certain myths, in certain sort of mythological interpretations of America, especially with the first real step of statement here was Pogo. Walt Kelly's famous comic strip, which got started and which had a lot of imagination and a lot of flair and dash and so on. But Pogo starts getting political. That was the important thing. And you had the senator, who was obviously Joe McCarthy, trying to run down Rock. What were these chickens from Rhode Island? Rhode Island Reds, right? And who were obviously the people that Senator Joe McCarthy was trying to get at. And suddenly, comic strips were no longer simply, only comic strips, nor were they only dealing with happy endings and with the old myths of the 30s and 40s, like the old Bobbsey Twin stories. We could have talked about the Bobbsey Twin stories, you know, there was an America that was nice, but never really existed and so on. But anyway, starting with Pogo, we see the introduction of immediate, concrete, political questions and controversies into this world we call popular culture, into the world which was on the comic page where young people, that young people read. And the movement continued to grow into the 1960s. And the culmination of this, and I'll just go through Doonesbury very quickly, the culmination of this comes in 1968, I think is the exact date, when Gary Trudeau, who was an undergraduate at Yale University, started drawing a comic strip, mainly at first to spoof some of the sacred cows at Yale. His first one was the president of Yale, and then he went after the famous quarterback, J.B., with various characters, and these caught on and started expanding. He got a syndicate to sell his comic strip to different parts of the country, and now, of course, it's a major, one, I think, the most important expression of the myths and the hopes really of young people that we have in the country. That's my own particular conviction on this. And what we find in Doonesbury is not a total reversal, but a drastic change from the old days of Jack Armstrong, because now the hero has become the anti-hero. He's kind of fumbling, he's sometimes slow to learn, he makes a lot of mistakes. He never really gets a hold of a situation, but somehow he sort of stumbles through. I suppose you could say by grace rather than by the law or something here, because by obeying the law, by obeying the codes of established morality and all the rest, he really doesn't get very far. In fact, he gets in all kinds of trouble by doing this. And furthermore, with Doonesbury, there is criticism, usually in good faith, but there is criticism of all the old sacred institutions, all the old sacred cows. Colleges are under criticism all the time. There is a criticism of activist clergy. I think it's Dan Berrigan who must be the one who is now suddenly nowhere because he doesn't have a cause he can join anymore, and he's sitting around looking for a cause, and there's no cause anymore. And this would indicate, you know, how willing Trudeau is to take on anybody, because if anybody was almost a sacred cow, it would have been Daniel Berrigan for his work in the anti-war and the anti-draft movement of the late 60s and the early 70s. Furthermore, there is a really sort of a very strong endorsement of the women's movement. Joni Caucus, for instance, leaves her family and goes to work for the daycare center, and now becomes involved in politics, trying to run to support a candidate who's running another a woman who's running for political office. And there's no condemnation of her, you know, leaving the family. It's and no condemnation of her even when she left the daycare center. Because this was something she had to do for herself, which is a long ways away from the old days, you see, of Jack Armstrong on this. There is, of course, very sharp criticism of American participation in Vietnam. We have the fearless Viet Cong terrorist who has a heart of gold and is a little dumb, really, in Fred, P-H-R-E-D. And when you can make the, quote, enemy out to be sort of bumbling and silly and kind of harmless in the last analysis, you've gone a long ways from the old days when I used to stab pictures of, you know, of Japanese figures along the way. There are no heroes. There are no necessary happy endings. There is no guarantee in Doonesbury that if you follow the established code of morality that you're going to succeed, that you're going to get ahead. The old gospel of success simply becomes, you know, one way to inculcate free enterprise ideals in people rather than being the guarantee to upward mobility and happy endings in America. And furthermore, what's just the last point, is that Doonesbury really is the creation of myths and heroes and ideals by young people themselves, and they know this is theirs, this is what the world they have created, and it's nothing which is handed down to them, which was the case with Jack Armstrong and the serials, the radio serials of the 1930s and the 40s. We simply accepted what was told us as to this is the way the world is, this is the way life is in America, and we obeyed because we had no options or we had no alternatives at that time. Now, with Doonesbury and all the rest, young people are creating their own world, their own ideals, and they are simply no longer listening to or dependent on the kinds of established norms, the gospel of success, if you like, the achievement syndrome that you find in Doonesbury. And I would simply stop there and ask if this is a gain or a loss, if this is a move ahead or a step backwards for you. How do you react to my little diagnosis?
I think two other things that, if I can,
sure.
Since you butted in yesterday first, I can today. Two other things that Doonesbury really illustrates a shift in that was true of Jack Armstrong is, first of all, when you talked about the audience listening to Jack Armstrong as we, it really was an Anglo-Saxon Protestant
yes.
audience. All the names, can you think of a name of any hero
yeah,
prior to 1960 who has a non-English name? Dick Tracy, Jack Armstrong, and all of the rest, and that work ethic too is essentially a Protestant work ethic. And then the second thing it seems to me, and whereas in Doonesbury now you're beginning to get all sorts of names of, if your name was Italian before 1960, you were part of the villain crew, and you know, Dr. Lasagna or whatever. But it seems to me another important shift that Doonesbury has made is that in Jack Armstrong and in Dick Tracy and in Little Orphan Annie, evil
once it's located, it's always located someplace outside the group, and,
yeah.
and we can breathe easier because we are not guilty, we are not responsible. It is somehow outside American culture. Evil is in that evil person, and once he's done with, you know, we are the innocent. But in Doonesbury, nobody is innocent. We are all a little bit silly. We are all a bit, as we are in Mad Magazine, too, which came in the late 50s at about that time. We're all stupid.
A little bit guilty.
Yeah, right.
And much more attention to what we would call ambiguity rather than the case before. I think that's true. I agree wholeheartedly.
You were asking us just before that if value judgments of some type. I see, just from my own background, the same as yours, I see that the young people today actually have to take on a greater degree of responsibility for their decisions than we ever did. We had them, like you say, really late. And now they have this tremendous burden, I think, of having to question authority, of having to question the institutions. And I correlate this very much with maybe even our bicentennial year to our early leaders. In the revolution, maybe they were courageous men. They were rich. They were wealthy. They really had little thoughts toward the poor as such, as it finally came out. But they had to take on the burden for everyone to question this authority of England, that type of thing. And it came out good in our case, it doesn't mean. But I think in the long run, and as long as the institutions start realizing that they are to be questioned and encourage questioning, I think this can become a very strong factor in producing a America that will be truly, truly worthy of the world. One that we can truly start to understand all the peoples of the world and work towards a more of a common good than we ever could in the past. Isolationism and such, it will be
well taken. I saw a couple of other hands. I hope they didn't go down. Yeah.
It seems to me that the situation now is closer, I'm trying to figure out how to put this so that I'll say what I really mean, closer to the Christian idea of the nature of man, or and woman.
Mankind.
because, and also, I think this trend away from the concept of patriotism and Christianity being inseparably entwined, I like that. The fact that they are separating,
mm-hmm.
because in the old concept, it seemed to me that if you were Christian, you automatically had to be super patriot in quotation marks. So
the God was on our side. Yeah, I didn't bring up in the old Jack Armstrong. There was all sort of a vague Protestantism in general. Moralism in the background there sometimes. They did go to church, but you never knew which sort of church it was. You know, sort of a, when you started a prayer, it was to whom it may concern. kind of salutation. And that's gone down the drain, I think. And probably, you know, I think constructively so.
Erling, do you think Doonesbury, you talked about Jack Armstrong and the things he was for, and Doonesbury and the things he is against. Do you detect in the Doonesbury strip anything positive? Does he stand for something?
Well,
it's easy as Mad Magazine does to simply knock everything and laugh at it.
Yeah,
then put it back together.
In a way, it does. It's sort of a constructive stance by negation when you subtract all the things that they're against and you know what's left.
I guess that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, really, there is a sort of a basic, no matter what else goes wrong in the world, we have other people on which we can rely and we can lean on and we can trust. And what happens in Doonesbury is when there is sort of an open, direct kind of communication and people are honest with their own feelings, such as Joni Caucus was or Zonker was, for instance, with their own feelings, somehow there is a kind of redemption there. There is a kind of freedom from making the terrible mistakes that the ultra-super people, like the football player, the super jock who can't see anything wrong with what he's doing, or the college president or the clerical activist can't do. And those people who are honest with themselves and doing what they really think they should be doing are the ones who come out, if anything, a little bit better than the others. And they don't look look quite as foolish as the others. I don't know. Sometimes with Doonesbury, and this is what I like what you said, there is much greater awareness of the specific problems of the world. And that's, I think, a step ahead, because the world isn't just a matter of, you know, right and wrong and good and evil, but you get involved in these sort of things. And the ambiguity that comes with that kind of knowledge, the loss of innocence, I suppose you could say. Sometimes with Doonesbury, there really isn't so much as an attempt to do what Jack Armstrong did, but simply introduce people to, you know, the world in the way it is. And sometimes it's Trudeau's own editorial statements as to what the world is like. Some newspapers put Doonesbury on the editorial page and not on the comic strip page, which I think is an interesting commentary.
A radical democracy feeling there that you count, so the individual.
Yes, very much.
He's talking to Nixon, remember, and he says, well, that, you know, that bastard would be, yours isn't worth what it was before. No, he says, neither is the dollar.
But there is an attempt, there is an attack on sacred cows, but it's almost always the sacred cows which need attacking. My favorite is, one of the all-time favorite strips is, when Duke goes to China to be the ambassador, and it's obviously Hunter S. Thompson, and you know, the world, if Hunter S. Thompson is being held up to young people, you know, as some sort of model, we've come a long way since, you know, Jack Armstrong. Some of you take a look at Fear and Loathing on the campaign trail, or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, right. But Hunter Thompson is listening, I'm sorry, Duke, who is obviously battered after Thompson, is listening to this little Chinese band play. You remember when Nixon first arrived in Peking, this little band, they had that funny little bass horn, I remember, playing Home on the Range. I thought that was so sweet, really. They were wanting to make Nixon feel right at home, or the president feel right at home, and it was an old, wonderful old American folk song. And so Duke was listening to this little band, and they played Home on the Range, and then there was this translator, this wonderful, you know, girl with the glasses, and so on, who's very cool, you know, and this marvelous, this time when Mao Zedong thought that, you know, Duke was David Eisenhower, because, you know, Mao Zedong isn't very bright anymore. And so anyway, there was a band, the band was playing, and she said, we want you to feel right at home because we're going to serenade you with some all-time American classic folk songs. And the first was Home on the Range, and she said, and now we're going to play the other great American folk song, Rocky Mountain High. And Duke says, Lord, take me now. Because John Denver simply has become an industry and not a folk singer. And that was a marvelous little, you know, zinger in there, I suppose you could say, yeah.
I wonder whether it's quite fair to follow the sequence you do in taking the soap opera for kids, Jack Armstrong, and comparing it to the comic strip. I heard someplace that TV is, and I would guess a lot of it, is a mirror rather than a window. I think that could be said about Jack Armstrong, that kind of emphasis mirrored what our elders, you know, thought we should know or
yeah.
got to. I wonder if it wouldn't be more fair to say that TV, some of the TV production, not for kids necessarily, but some of the TV things more accurately mirror what is the present American myth that are attempted. Now, I'll grant you that these shifts have happened all the same, but I wonder what we're saying. What if we did these things that we did with Jack Armstrong and lived into them, this sort of thing? I suspect that some of our kids do some of this as far as TV is concerned, and I wonder what we're putting in on laying on there, and with the violence or the.
Well, I should have brought it out at this time for lunch. If anybody wants to split, that. That
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay. Paul's the official guardian of the time. That what's happened, somebody mentioned it too, that children mature much earlier than they did before. And hence, Jack Armstrong would appeal to people, I think, 10, 12, 13, 14, and so on. And because we had, by comparison, a delayed, you know, adolescence, I suppose you could say, whereas today the kids with television and all the rest see the world much more clearly and much more accurately because it's visual in that sense compared to it being audio from the days of radio when you had to use your imagination. And hence they grow up much more quickly. And they want sort of anti-hero, anti-establishment figures such as they find in Doonesbury, and they feel very strongly that it's theirs. You know, it's just like rock music. It's something that's theirs, and they aren't going to take it away. Remember when they proved that rock music, loud rock music, was really damaging to your eardrums, and it was creating permanent damage? And a lot of kids said, we don't care, it's our music, and if it's our ears, and if we want to, you know, destroy our ears, we should have the right to do so. And it's I think the same thing is true with Doonesbury. It's, there is an appeal, directly appeal to them. They know that it's appealing to them. Mm-hmm. And that there is the code there that comes through very clearly. They understand it like the spoofs on John Denver, because a lot of parents are happy with John Denver. It's all butterflies and moonlight and, you know, and griddles on the cake, cakes on the griddle or whatever, and all this sort of business. And really underneath, the young people are laughing at John Denver. And that's the kind of we went through the whole John Denver thing, and I stood in line 6 hours with my daughter to get into a John Denver concert, and it was nice, you know. This too shall pass away. But anyway,
I was going to say, though, I think comic strips and any of these are an art form, and I think art in general, and I'm certainly no art critic, but I think it generally overstates something in order to make a point. And I think you can work yourself up in an all sweat, you know, that Doonesbury is too cynical, and if we go down this road, America will be destroyed, and what's happening to our young people.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
Yeah, I think most of our, at least from the high school age on up, I think young people today are far more sophisticated than we were. And I think they see that, you know, you can't live in an over cynical world either.
Yes. Yeah, there's a return to this, some sort of affirmation. That wasn't the case even 5, 6, 7 years ago, which I think is a very healthy thing. And there is kind of an idealism in Doonesbury that shows through with some of these people who are honest with themselves and who are willing to admit mistakes.
But they live in a world without illusions.
Without illusions, yeah, well, that's true. But they're not without hope, though. Doonesbury doesn't destroy hope. Somehow, some of these things, if you can destroy false illusions, then the world is open for you to create a better, you know, there is opportunity for hope beyond that. But the first step always is to destroy illusions, and false illusions, I should say.
We had a reorganization of our paper, in particular the comic section in our city, just for many years. The readership had an opportunity to vote which comic strips it preferred. And on each age category, the top comic strip was Doonesbury. I don't think that we can categorically say it was a young folk strip.
No, but
I think that in itself is revelatory, because even those of us that have grown up with Jack Armstrong have come along.
But there are a lot of us young people in our age group who are pulling for the young people, and we sort of, I'd like to identify with the young people and say that since that's one of their big things, you know, I like rock music, and I like it mainly because I had to in order to survive in our house. And it took me a couple of years, but now I'm with it, you know, and it becomes a way of staying young. Yeah, I hope so. But there are some places where, you know, some newspapers have banned it, for instance. That won't use it, even though they could afford it.
Were you talking about Andy Capp while I was dozing off?
No, I didn't talk about Andy Capp.
That's another subject.
That's a whole other thing, right. Well, it is 5-2 now, and...
Do you realize that a month after Roosevelt was elected his third term, Gray killed off Daddy Warbuck?
Oh.
And a month after Roosevelt died, he was brought back again, because Gray said there's hope for the world.